Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is GE Betts versus Z Company. Mr. Pugh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I represent GE Betts along with my partner, Dennis Johnson, and my associates, Rachel Steiner and Rebecca Fuentes. This Court has already ruled that the registration of the North Carolina judgment in the Circuit Court of Cook County is, at bottom, a supplementary proceeding, not a separate lawsuit, and therefore does not carry the burden of subject matter jurisdiction. The Court is citing Barrows versus Hunter, a 1878 case, and Travelers Property versus Good in support of its ruling. The Court has also ruled that the third-party citation against Harris changed the nature of the proceedings because that citation presented an independent controversy with a new and different party. And finally, the Court ruled that with regard to Harris's status in this matter, if viewed as a party, Harris, as an Illinois citizen, is subject to the forum defendant rule, and therefore the proceedings was not removable pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1441 B and C. If Harris is not a party, then there is no jurisdiction to remove the supplemental proceedings. Z's arguments in response does not directly answer its dilemma. Z argues that even if the forum defendant rule was violated here, this Court should excuse that error under the Supreme Court ruling in Caterpillar versus Lewis. But this case before this Court is fundamentally different than the Caterpillar Court ruling. This Court should not extend Caterpillar to a case like this. Why? First, as a policy matter, the Caterpillar Court stated that the procedural requirements for removal remain enforceable by federal district courts. Therefore, this Court should not easily ignore the unerasable statutory violation committed by Z and Harris. The forum defendant error was never cured and remains a statutory violation. Second, this case is distinguished from Caterpillar because the proceedings in this Court are post-judgment proceedings. Liability and damage issues were adjudicated after five years of litigation and an extensive trial in the North Carolina courts. Z was found liable to GE Betts for tortious interference with contract, unfair and deceptive trade practices, and misappropriation of trade secrets. In the case before this Court, the District Court did not rule that the North Carolina judgment registered in Illinois was void. GE Betts still holds an Illinois registered judgment that is valid and enforceable and will be for at least the next 7 years, as most judgments. During that period of time, the priority issue could disappear by Z's repayment of Harris loan or the accumulation of substantially more revenues by Z, or many things that can occur. And beyond the 7 years, of course, if re-registered, that judgment can last years and years. So with regard to the proceedings here, it's that it's fundamentally different than Caterpillar.
But the main principle is the same, isn't it? Which is to say that the Court can overlook a statutory violation as long as there's not a jurisdictional issue, which is a separate matter. But if what we have here is just a statutory violation, the Court can overlook it if the case is proceeded to final judgment in the interest of judicial efficiency and finality and effective use of judicial resources. I think that's the import of the Caterpillar decision.
And, Your Honor, that's correct what the Caterpillar Court said, that given the error there, the two things that occurred. The most fundamental error was subject matter jurisdiction, which was cured. And secondly, that the unerasable procedural error, because it occurred at that time, even though corrected later, was, as you said, unerasable. So it was a procedural error that the Court said could be forgiven, in effect, under certain circumstances, given the policy of that the Court should attempt to enforce all of the statutory provisions. But then it went on to look at finality as you suggested, efficiency and economy.
Right, but if all we have here is a procedural violation in the removal based on the forum defendant rule and no underlying jurisdictional problem, then it seems to me the Caterpillar case applies, although it's a discretionary judgment on our part about whether the interest in finality and judicial economy favor your position here.
Yes.
The other jurisdictional problem?
Caterpillar does hold that, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting to the court is that this post-judgment proceedings is fundamentally different. And therefore, the issues other than the forum defendant issue, which we agree with the court did excuse that particular error. In this case, it should not. And because of the fact that the finality, efficiency, and economy, including the nature of the proceedings here, post-judgment proceedings, should not, the court should take that into consideration.
Right. You've made some jurisdictional arguments, too, in addition to the improper removal or perhaps the improper removal under the forum defendant rule. And those, apparently you're not waiving, but you haven't talked about them yet. And that, it seems to me, would be primary.
Let me just put a footnote with regard to the subject matter jurisdictional distinction versus procedural. What I'm suggesting to the court also look at one of the fundamental principles that even Caterpillar suggested, is that the way to look at subject matter jurisdiction is at the time of filing the proceeding. And here, if you looked at the subject matter jurisdiction when it involves diversity issues, at the time that GE Betts filed registered its judgment, as this court has said, there was no subject matter jurisdiction. It's only with the inclusion of the third party citation that there's subject matter jurisdiction. We say that that's a distinction also with regard to Caterpillar. So when it comes to finality, Judge Shader's ruling was premature because there was no hearing or trial, not even one deposition was taken. And as I said, the case must still...
What's the jurisdictional flaw?
Well, Your Honor, the fact is that a registered judgment does not carry subject matter jurisdiction. And Z, as a defendant, could not have filed a removal action in this court. That's all.
Complete diversity.
Pardon, Your Honor?
We have complete diversity. So there is jurisdiction under the diversity jurisdiction provision.
That's correct, Your Honor. But if you look at 1441, the other provision that Travelers said was very important is that you have to have a civil action. And the civil action is goes in accordance with 1441 that says a civil action where the court has original jurisdiction may be removed, etc. So one of the requirements that Travelers require was that you had to have a civil action. And that's why post-judgment proceedings our supplementary proceedings are not civil actions until the event that you have a Harris citation proceeding, and then that makes it as a new and independent matter with a new party, then you have subject matter jurisdiction. With regard to the finality issue,
with respect
issue
to
also,
the forum defendant issue, your initial objection to removal did not address that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The very first motion we filed in response, we had about 3 hours, as I said, to file that paper with the court on a TRO motion. And we did not raise it the very first time, but we did raise it.
So isn't there a waiver of that provision by failing to raise it in your initial objection?
No, Your Honor. We raised it within the 30-day period required by 1447. And this court has already ruled that portion of it we satisfy. And that just simply because of the fact that we didn't raise it at the very first time we had an opportunity, that in itself did not mean that we could not raise it within the 30-day period. So the other thing that I would say as a practical matter, having been there, what happened in that proceeding was we originally raised the subject matter jurisdiction issues, and the court denied that. As a result of denying that, then it left open in its ruling the fact that Harris was indeed a third-party citation respondent. And therefore, we thought if Harris is a citation respondent, it couldn't fulfill 1441B. And so we filed our motion to reconsider. And the judge also, in its proceedings, raised this issue but ruled against it, said that Harris was indeed was not bound by the 1441B forum defendant restriction. So, as I said, this case must also be removed to the Circuit Court of remanded to the Circuit Court of Cook County for further proceedings on GE Betts's valid and enforceable $7.6 million registered judgment. And as a judicial lien creditor, GE Betts should still be allowed to pursue discovery of Z's other assets pursuant to the Illinois post-judgment procedures, thinking about the section 1442, where we get discovery not even of Harris, but other third parties and other assets.
That's a merits argument if the case remains in federal court?
Say that again, Your Honor?
That's an argument to the merits if the case remains in federal court, that you want the judgment reversed so that you can go back and take discovery on the...
Our other position, Your Honor, is if you agree with Judge Shader's decision that indeed there is a dismissal of the citation, that's the third-party citation against Harris we're focusing on, there is no jurisdiction then in the federal courts because that then gave the jurisdiction in the beginning. So if indeed you follow Judge Shader's decision, we still have to deal with the issue of what happens next. And we say that because of the fact that subject matter jurisdiction was given by the Harris citation, once removed, then there is no longer subject matter jurisdiction. And just as a practical matter, when we talk about the finality and things of that nature, you know that we never got complete discovery, but there were clear indications that Z had other assets beyond the UCC priority issue. And that is, as we all know, the UCC does not govern real estate. And in that particular matter, we think that there may be some real estate out there. We don't know for sure. We never got complete discovery, but we believe there is. And equipment, as an example, we know that they have equipment. The UCC filing does not deal with the issue of perfection of equipment. And we'll also talk about the deposit accounts. So with regard to efficiency and economy under Caterpillar, those concerns do not outweigh the statutory error committed here. Again, the proceeding before Judge Shader was a supplemental proceeding. It lasted only 2.5 months, not years. Very little discovery was allowed, so efficiency and economy won't be issues upon remand.
Why is it that once the asset discovery citation is filed, once the asset discovery citation is filed on Harris Bank in the state court, why isn't that a sufficiently distinct proceeding from the underlying merits, which had already been adjudicated in North Carolina court, to support removal?
You said why isn't it supporting?
Why isn't it enough to support removal? Once a new party, the bank that's holding at least some of the assets, is brought into the picture. So this is not just a fight between the judgment debtor and the judgment creditor anymore.
That's correct, Your Honor.
As in an ordinary supplementary proceeding. You've got a new party being brought in here with a priority secured lien. Why isn't that sufficiently distinct from the underlying merits to support removal?
Because of the fact that if you go back and you dismiss the citation, as Judge Shader did, then that citation no longer is viable.
But at the time of removal, there was a jurisdictional basis for removal.
Oh, yes.
Your Honor, all you've got left is your procedural argument. This gets back to my earlier question. If all you've got left is a procedural argument, not a jurisdictional argument, then, you know, at least arguably, the Caterpillar case does come into play on the basis of the interest of finality and judicial economy and so forth.
Yeah, I would just ask the court, we agree fundamentally with what you're saying that, and this court in Hurley has held, that the forum defendant rule is not subject matter jurisdictional, but is procedural. So we endorse that, but in the analysis and answering Your Honor's question, the fact is that there's always more that you can look at here on the subject matter jurisdiction issue. And what we're saying from, I'll say it in the best way I can, with regard to the nicety of parsing out whether forum defendant rule is purely procedural or are there any other aspects of it. Hurley says it's procedural. All I'm suggesting to the court is once the judge ruled that that third-party action, the citation of Harris, was quashed, it lost jurisdiction of the registration portion of that judgment. And that's the registration that we filed in the Circuit Court of Cook County. And that's the judgment that will continue to be enforced and prosecuted. So that's the difference we're making. Caterpillar, okay, on the other hand, pardon?
I think I get your line of thought here. The order of the district court purports to decide more than just the discovered assets that Harris was holding.
Yes.
I think is what your argument is. It purports to decide the lien priority for everything.
For everything.
Nationwide, and wherever the assets can be found, not just the two accounts that Harris holds.
That's true, Your Honor. That's what the district court thought it was doing. And we're saying that that was there.
Okay.
Yeah. The other reason is that even if, and we do, in accordance with Hurley, suggest that the forum defendant rule is procedural, it doesn't solve the issue. It just merely asks the next question that Caterpillar asked, how about finality, efficiency, and economy? That's the only reason why the court gave as a policy matter that you can then avoid the error, the unerasable error that the court identified. One of the other areas.
Did you want, Mr. Beale, I don't want to interrupt you, but.
I got fine.
No, it's your time, however, but the rebuttal time has started, so if you want to use it, you certainly may.
Just one quick point. Obviously, that we don't think the court will get to the merits of the judge's ruling, but if it did, it seems fairly clear that under the UCC, the first in and first out, the first in time, first in right concept was not valid here. And we gave you the reasons under the UCC. And in addition, there are a number of cases out there that says that when you have a situation like the judgment debtor Z, who has been in default and the primary secured lender declares that default, then the primary secured lender cannot just sit and do nothing. It cannot just simply hold at bay all the other creditors. It must follow its own documents and also follow the default provisions under the UCC.
Right, but all that means is that you would then take subject to the set-off rights.
No, set-off, Your Honor, here, as a matter of fact, they never set off anything. They just simply said, Harris, that we have that right. But in order to have that right, at the time that a judgment creditor is seeking to enforce its right, you have to perform, you have to set off the
right,
amount.
Right, but the line of cases that you're citing for that, the line of UCC cases, it's not a complete forfeiture. It allows the judgment creditor to proceed against the assets, but subject to the first priority security interest holder's right of set off, should they decide to declare the default and move ahead with it, which, arguably happened here. I mean, there's a factual dispute about whether what Harris Bank did in calling this loan was enough.
Yes, Your Honor. What we say there with regard to that issue is that the set-off right is contingent, as Your Honor has said, upon declaring default and then exercising that right. And to the extent that they don't exercise that right, have they waived that right? That issue we have not found in the cases that we have looked at, but I would think that the way the main cases go, that if you don't exercise your right of set-off, then you can't just simply hold it and say, I have a right, and allow the debtor to continue to operate as though it was in its normal business time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Pugh. Mr. Boris?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Stephen Boris, and I represent the defendant in this case, Z Company. I'm going to begin with the first premise. and that is that the district court had jurisdiction of this matter at all times. From the time we removed the citation right through the district court's final ruling on November 28, 2012. Under Caterpillar, because the court reached a final determination on the merits, any procedural error that may have been committed with respect to the removal is deemed waived, and the judgment, if appropriate, can be upheld. Now, let me also mention that under 1441, only a defendant can remove. We were the only defendant in this case. It's not the registration of judgment that presented the contested issue. It was the citation to discover assets that presented the contested issue. 1441 is to be narrowly construed, and we've cited, and my counsel, co-counsel with Harris Bank, have cited several cases, including Gross versus Deborah Ardenas, Constantine versus Fogel, and a decision out of this circuit, Thomas versus Shelton, which indicated that only defendants and not interested parties can remove. Since we were the only defendant, we were the party that was able to remove the action, not Harris Bank, and Harris Bank didn't join in that removal. But even if the court would have deemed that the removal was somehow an error, GE waived that issue. On September 14th, we appeared on a motion for injunctive relief, two sessions before the district court, in the morning and in the afternoon. GE never raised the forum defendant rule, either in the morning or in the afternoon session, ever.
So that's great speed by the district court, and very commendable, but the need to raise defects to removal, there's a 30-day period in which you can do that. So you're saying that without raising that immediately, that's a waiver?
They had an opportunity to raise that defect on September 14th in two sessions. That was certainly within the 30-day rule. But they never argued form defendant rule in those sessions. In their written papers, they never raised it. Now, we come back 6 days later on September 20th on our motion for injunctive relief. Again, it's never raised. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that GE finally raised the form defendant rule. And we know from this court...
So if a challenge to a removal is made any time within that 30 days, it has to have every aspect to it that would point out a defect.
Yes.
You're saying that there is a waiver if it's not all brought at once.
Yes. Arguments raised for the first time in a motion to reconsider are deemed waived. This court has announced that in Brooks versus City of Chicago, as well as in Block versus Frischholz. So they had their opportunity.
Sure, as a general matter, that's true. But with respect to removal defects in particular, you've got some authority that those are waived if they're not, if the very first effort at challenging removal doesn't include something like forum defendant.
We did not cite authority that says that you've had to have raised it in your very first argument, but we know that they didn't, and they had these at least two opportunities. But we have a brighter bulb reason for why they waived the issue, and that is that before they presented their motion to reconsider, they filed a separate citation issued by the district court to Z. Now, that's an invocation of the court's jurisdiction. They filed a motion to modify the TRO themselves for their own benefit with the district court, and then they issued a deluge of discovery.
Well, so what are they supposed to do once they lose the argument against removal?
Well,
just we lay down and accept everything that happens?
No, not at all. But we cited Kaner versus Harrell Fire and Bernstein versus Lynn Waldock, a case out of this circuit, where the court suggested they could have withdrawn those invocations of the federal court's jurisdiction. They expressed consent by having the separate citation issued to Z.
Once they lose the removal argument, they have to litigate the case, be permitted to litigate the case without being declared to have waived the removal argument.
My point is that they didn't raise the removal argument until their motion for reconsideration.
Right, but you raised this as a separate basis for waiver, and certainly litigation conduct. Once they argued against removal and lost, right, then they were permitted to litigate the case without being held to have waived an argument against removal.
Agreed. I'm suggesting that those three steps that they took were a consent then to the court's jurisdiction. If they didn't want to consent, they should have withdrawn the motion for TRO that they filed, or modification of the TRO. They should have withdrawn the citation that they issued separately to Zeke.
I think we're talking past each other. I understand you have an argument about waiver of the forum defendant rule, but there was litigation about whether removal was, or there was a contest about whether removal was appropriate.
Correct.
So they preserved an argument against removal, and they lost that. So then they proceeded to litigate the question, the questions having to do with the asset discovery. And they cannot be held to have waived an argument against removal by virtue of having done that. They aren't required to forego all their litigation options after they lose the removal argument.
No, but if you refer to this court's decision in Bernstein versus Lynn Waldock, where Judge Posner addressed similar issues, if a plaintiff believes that the matter was improperly removed, is convinced, it will have its position vindicated on appeal. It shouldn't throw in the towel. It should stick to its guns. And I'm suggesting that by filing a separate motion for modification of the preliminary injunction, by having a wholly new citation issued, it was clearly signaling that the forum defendant rule did not apply. And we don't think the forum defendant rule applies because we're the only defendant in this case. Now, we have a separate matter because we have a citation issued to a third party in Harris, but that's a whole new controversy. And clearly, under Caterpillar, when Judge Shader considered this matter and made a decision, any error in the removal process should be overlooked and the final decision, the adjudication of the merits, should be turned to.
So if the judge moves quickly enough, this whole matter of jurisdiction doesn't really matter. The whole matter of federal jurisdiction doesn't matter. If the judge can get that thing to judgment before the party opposing removal can get to Court of Appeals, then Caterpillar just takes care of it, and it doesn't really matter.
Well, let me say this. That if the court is suggesting that Judge Shader acted with undue haste, I must remind you that according to
The Caterpillar case, it went all the way through a jury trial. It was litigated, I think, in excess of 4 years and so forth. And as I say, Judge Shader's speed is commendable here, but it's lightning fast when there's a very serious removal issue presented.
I understand. But the matter was significantly litigated. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent in a matter of 3 months.
Which is curious. What would an appeal bond have cost Z in North Carolina?
Well, Judge, it's interesting that you would have brought that up. Twice, my client attempted to bond the underlying judgment. Both times, GE objected to the surety company. The last time we attempted bond, it was just a couple of weeks ago after this court issued the January 23rd order. Given the vagaries of the decisions coming out of the court in North Carolina, we felt it would have been futile to have gone before the court to have had the bonds approved. But the last bond that was offered was in excess of $8 million. So there was an attempt to bond this matter. But let me address, if I can, quickly the issue of the speed with which Judge Shader ruled. There were 10 hearings before the trial court in those 3 months. There were 13 pleadings filed by Z in excess of 1,200 pages, 22 pleadings filed by GE in excess of 1,600 pages, and Harris filed 7 for a total of in excess of 33,000 pages of pleadings and motions and 10 hearings and discovery. We produced over 8,000 pages of documents in discovery. We offered depositions. They never took the depositions that were offered. So we think that the final decision that Judge Shader rendered on November 28th should be affirmed in its entirety. He did move quickly, but as Judge Posner pointed out in RTC versus Ruggiero, supplemental proceedings, which is how these began, are to be swift, cheap, and informal. They weren't cheap, they weren't informal, and they weren't swift, given that the decision that had to be rendered on the priority issue was a simple legal issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Voorhees. Mr. Garvey?
Good morning, Your Honor and Counsel, and may it please the Court. Along with my colleague Cindy Stuyvesant, I represent BMO Harris Bank. I'd like to start by focusing on the Form Defendant Rule 2. And, of course, we join in Z Company's argument that a waiver occurred here by reason under Brooks and Block.
Speaking of joining, though, you have not joined in the removal, correct?
That's correct, Judge.
Nor have you consented,
Your Honor,
to it.
That's correct. And our position, Your Honor, is that that consent isn't needed because the language in 1441 is that only a defendant may remove in 1441A. In 1441B, the language is similar. Only a defendant may remove.
But we said in the Travelers case that a citation respondent could be construed as a defendant for purposes of removal in a situation like this.
The citation respondent in the Travelers case, however, Your Honor, was situated differently than Harris in this case. In that case, the citation respondent was Harris, and the plaintiff in that case had taken an assignment of rights under an insurance policy issued by Travelers, and so Travelers was, in fact, the party that was potentially liable to the plaintiff. And that's the definition of defendant, as we pointed out in our appellate briefs. Here, Harris Bank isn't a defendant under any construction of the term.
But the dispute between Z and Betts is an ancillary matter to the North Carolina judgment. It is a collection matter, which would not ordinarily be removable to federal court.
The mere fact of registration of the judgment by GE in the Circuit Court of Cook County, we agree with this court, would not be removable. But upon the service of a citation, and I would say not just the service of the citation on Harris, which was the first citation served, but on the service of any citation that would raise an independent controversy, this is under Travelers, then it becomes removable.
So that sort of destroys the concept that ancillary matters of collection judgments are not removable. Because what else are you going to do but issue citations to try to find those assets somewhere?
Well, the difference here, Your Honor, is that there was an issue of lien priority. In many collection cases, upon the issuance of a citation, a deposit account holding bank with no mortgage loan, with no other loans to the debtor, simply answers the citation by swearing under oath to what assets are held, and then the plaintiff files a motion for a turnover order. In this case, however,
defendant with a registered judgment against them could remove the case as soon as the citation is issued under your argument.
It could. And it could be not only if there's an issue, only if there's a new issue in the case. A new issue was raised in this case of lien priority, the competing claims of GE on the one hand and Harris Bank on the other to the assets of Z. That's a new and independent controversy that the federal appellate courts have said does not give rise to a concern about this just being supplementary or ancillary or satellite litigation, but rather a new controversy. The underlying case in North Carolina, which counsel described, had nothing to do, of course, with lien priority. It was restrictive covenant and trade secrets case. Harris, of course, was not involved in that litigation. It only became involved in the issue of lien priority as a new and independent action or controversy that became removable upon service of a citation.
Right, and why isn't your client, Harris Bank, the defendant in that new proceeding?
Well, because the courts have said, Your Honor, that a party or an interested person need not be classified as a defendant in order to assert its rights.
You want it both ways. You want the citation to discover assets to be a sufficiently independent action to support removal, but not your client's status as a defendant for purposes of the form defendant rule. Well, I don't think you can have it both ways. Well, it's got to be all or nothing.
Well, I would respectfully disagree under the narrow construction of the term defendant in 1441B. And under case authority like Tessio Construction, where and the Deutsche Bank case and the Gross and Constantine cases, where interested persons, for example, in the Deutsche Bank case, a District of Connecticut case, an occupant of real estate, a tenant of real estate that was being foreclosed upon, was clearly interested in the dispute, and once served with something in the case, tried to remove it.
Does our Travelers case construe defendant so narrowly?
Well, I think Travelers was a very unique case in that the removing party / citation respondent also neatly fit within the definition of defendant, i.e. someone who can be liable to the plaintiff. I think if the court were to undertake an alignment or a realignment exercise here, it's really GE and Harris on one side going after Z's assets. Z's not getting those assets. The bank is, or GE is. They are adverse claimants to those assets. But just because we have an interest in the controversy doesn't mean we're a defendant, respectfully, for 1441B purposes. And I think it's been consistently construed in that narrow fashion so that only the defendant can remove and other parties who are interested cannot do so. Courts have ruled time and again. If Z had been the first party served with a citation instead of Harris, I would submit to the court that it could have removed because it had a contractual obligation to disclose and raise any lien that may be on the collateral that GE may be seeking to satisfy its judgment. So we weren't even a necessary citation respondent, if you will. We could have appeared, and the courts have said you don't need to appear as a party in order to protect your interest as a citation respondent. We could have appeared, but if it was just GE first serving Z, lien priority, an issue independent of the North Carolina controversy, is now raised. Travelers is satisfied. There's complete diversity between those parties. The matter is removable, and Harris Bank could have appeared, filed an appearance through us or other counsel, and came in to protect its lien rights. If I can just briefly address, there's a lot of commentary in the papers about the bank allegedly not taking any action upon default by Z, and it's simply not the case. The record is replete with evidence of the actions that the bank took to protect its lien interest once there was a default based upon the entry of a final judgment in the North Carolina State Court in middle 2012. The bank declared a default. It issued a notice of default with reservation of rights. It established a lockbox account and required Z to enter into a secure account agreement, a copy of which is provided to the court with the affidavit of Lauren Laborato, an officer of the bank, whereby the bank took ownership of all receipts into the Z accounts, took ownership, and except for North Carolina accounts receivable, which are subject to ex parte orders that are pending in the North Carolina State Court, the bank swept that account balance on a daily basis to pay down the loan. The authority that G, and there are other steps taken, establishing a reserve against collateral, requiring that Z report its current financial situation and projections on a go-forward basis. This is obviously a fluid situation. Under GE's scenario, a bank in Harris's position has one choice: liquidate. Accelerate and liquidate and force a bankruptcy. But as a secured creditor, that makes no commercial sense. If our only option, and no case says that's your only option, cases that talk about acceleration use the phrase such as acceleration.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but your time is running short, and I'd like to ask a question about the discovery about the alleged fraudulent transfer aspect of this case. Judge Shader decided this case without ruling on any of the discovery motions, just kind of went ahead and decided the merits with this substantial question sitting out there about whether this loan was a fraudulent transfer under the circumstances, and it does appear what we know of the record thus far is though there are several fraud markers here that would suggest the need for some discovery on that question.
Well, I would respectfully submit that Judge Shader, who had, by the time of the ruling on November 28th, I think four motions to compel, and motions even by our side to set a schedule so that these things can be decided.
Right.
So I would submit that he had in mind the scope of the discovery that GE was seeking at the point in time where he was comfortable, based upon the undisputed record, that the lien priority decision could be made. I'm not sure what markers or indicia of fraud you're referring to, Your Honor, but I would respectfully disagree to the extent there's any characterization of the record in that regard. This was, as Judge Shader correctly ruled, an arm's-length transaction where the bank loaned, entered into a credit facility with Z and co-borrowers, loaned money pursuant to that credit facility. It took out another bank, First Tennessee Bank, which had been in that position previously. There was nothing, I think Judge Shader's commentary on the record was, nothing, not even a whisper, not even a whisper of fraud connected to this transaction, as if somehow the bank and Z were in cahoots. There's just simply evidence of it whatsoever.
At the time this loan was issued, the BMO Harris was aware of the North Carolina proceeding, and that proceeding had gone to the point of decision but for the entry of judgment. It was just on the brink of the entry of judgment.
So as of December 2011, when the credit agreement was entered into, yes, the bank was aware that the litigation had been concluded, that a finding of liability had been made earlier in 2011, and then a judgment was not forthcoming until May of 2012. But, Your Honor, if that's the standard, that litigants who have had judgments of liability or even judgments entered against them cannot enter into commercial transactions out of concern that it would be deemed fraudulent somehow, no commercial transactions would be entered into. Z has appeal rights. It's filed an appeal and is pursuing an appeal in North Carolina.
Well, there's more to it than that, though. This was a security interest against all of Z's assets, was it not?
Yes, it is.
In the face of a large impending judgment, soon to grow larger based on the punitives award.
I think it
was at least arguably going to render the judgment debtor insolvent.
Well, a few things. And I think the key thing, and I know my time is up, but I think the key thing is we took out another lender. The assets were already encumbered by a loan and lien in favor of First Tennessee Bank. So
to the full extent that BMO Harris encumbered those assets?
I don't know what the outstanding indebtedness was at the time the loan was entered into, as I stand here.
I mean, that's what the discovery was intended to uncover, right?
Well,
at least in part. I mean, there were lots of discovery requests, but
you can't bring a fraudulent. This was a citation served upon the bank. If there are claims to be made against Z, those are claims for the North Carolina court that should have been brought in the North Carolina court as part of an underlying proceeding. The cases where in citation proceedings courts have allowed a tracing of assets are where the judgment debtor, in one case, I think it was the Dexia case versus Rogan, Seventh Circuit, 2010, the judgment debtor transferred assets into a trust for the benefit of his relatives. And so that was considered to be a fraudulent conveyance. He was considered to be the judgment debtor, the real party in interest with respect. There was nothing even remotely akin to that, and nor has there been citation to any case that would support an outcome that simply entering into a loan at a point in time where your borrower is at risk of a judgment being entered, again, I would submit that it would stop the wheels of commerce if that were the case. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Scarby. Mr. Pugh.
I'm sure I have another 15 minutes now, but I'm not going to use all of that time on rebuttal.
We'll try to be fair.
Yeah, no. The points that are made is that there was not even a whisper was the argument. Obviously, with the fraudulent transactions, the marshaling, the priority issues, there was a roar before the district court as to why it should continue, allow discovery, and make a decision on the merits. The waiver argument with regard to Caterpillar. In Caterpillar itself, Lewis, the defendant or plaintiff in that case, went all the way through that trial. Not just motions, pretrial motions, but a jury trial of some 6 days. I mean, as your honors have said, what is a loser of a motion to remand to do? Just fold his hand? So no, that clearly, even in Caterpillar, is not the solution. We have a right to contest as long as we timely filed our waiver. And with regard to whether or not GE Betts filed a bond, and we objected to it, whether Z filed a bond, and GE objected to it, it's clear that Z has its own rights under the statutory provisions of North Carolina. And even under the post-judgment proceedings and statutes in Illinois. So that really doesn't wash. The swiftness of an action, as this court has said over and over again, as a matter of policy and principle, ought to leave the parties with a sense of that they've had due process, that they've had their claims heard, whether denied or not. And that was not done here. This court just quickly from the very beginning, decided that the first-in-time, first-in-right analysis cleared everything off the board and swiftly tried to get there. At one point, even tried to, was going to hold me in contempt because we were moving too slow and that we were raising issues. So clearly, that's not the kind of proceedings where Caterpillar will have endorsed it and said the finality, efficiency, and economy.
Mr. Pugh, I just want to make sure I have the timing down. On the morning of September 14th, that's a couple days after removal.
Yes.
You made an oral motion objecting to removal, did you not?
Was that the one to modify the TRO?
Well, he indicated the case had been removed, and you had it, and you in the afternoon they had another hearing. So yeah. I just want
That morning.
Yes.
Yeah. We raised several objections that morning orally. And the court said, well, I need time to look at the cases that you've given me. Why don't Z and others and you supply any other cases, and we'll continue the hearing to 2 o'clock that afternoon. And we did
continue that. But in that morning, did Judge Shader indicate it had been properly removed?
No. Yes, I'm sorry, he did. He said it had been properly removed, but he gave us an opportunity to supply additional cases. Because he even read Travelers while he was on the bench that morning and said he read Travelers in a way that we had not read it. And finally, Your Honor, in this case, with regard to Harris filed an appearance both here and in the district court. It had asserted all of its rights as a defendant, and it's filed many of the actions, even coming here today, without leave of court. Most importantly, it has asserted its own rights of priority under its loan documents. In sum, Your Honor, on a practical basis, Harris walks like a defendant, looks like a defendant, and talks like a defendant. Therefore, it must be a defendant. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Pugh. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is